handle the jobs. Many of them were delighted with the prospect of getting an assured salary, although Amanda made certain that each bureaucrat had to satisfy a strict performance review annually to hold on to the job. Then came the selection of a governing board. 7 people were chosen at random by computer from the permanent residents of Ceres. No one was allowed to refuse the honor or the responsibility. Amanda was not selected by the computerized lottery, which disappointed her. George was, which disappointed him even more. At their first meeting, the board elected George their chief over his grudging protests. "I won't fucking shave," he warned them. "That's all right, George," said one of the young women on the board, "but could you just tone down your language a little?" Thus it was that big George Ambrose, now the reluctant mayor of the Rockrats, became their representative in the conference that took place at Cellini, where he had once lived as a fugitive and petty thief. "I'm not going by myself," George insisted. "I'll need some backup." The governing board decided they could afford to send 2 assistants with George. His first real decision as the newly elected chief administrator of Ceres was to pick the 2 people who would go with him. His first choice was easy, Dr. Chris Cardenas. As he tussled in his mind over who the other appointee should be, Amanda surprised him by volunteering for the post. She popped into his office, actually nothing more than his everyday living quarters, and told him that she wanted to be part of the delegation to Cellini.
"You?"
George blurted. "Ah, come." Amanda looked away from his eyes.
"I've done as much work to create this government as anyone. More, in fact. I deserve to go."
George said warily,
"This won't be a fucking vacation, you know."
"I understand that." He offered her his best chair, but she shook her head and remained standing in the middle of his one-room residence. She seemed calm and very determined.
"The place is pretty messy," George thought. "Bed's not made. Plates in the sink."
But Amanda simply stood there staring off into infinity, seeing what, George wondered.
"Humphreys is there, in Cellini," he said.
Amanda nodded, her face expressionless, frozen, as if she were afraid to show any emotion at all.
"Laz won't like you going."
"I know," she said, her voice almost a whisper. "I've thought it all out, George. I must go with you. But I don't want Laz to know. Please don't tell him."
Scratching his beard, trying to sort out what she was saying, George asked,
"How can I tell him? The only way I get anywhere to him is through you."
"I've got to go with you, George," Amanda said, almost pleading now. "Don't you see? I've got to do whatever I can to put an end to this fighting, to save Laz before they find him and kill him."
George nodded, finally understanding. At least he thought he did.
"All right, Amanda. You can come with us. I'll be glad to have you."
"Thank you, George," she said, smiling for the first time. But there was no happiness in it.
Amanda had wrestled with her conscience for 2 days before asking George to let her go with him to Cellini. She knew that Lars would not want her to be so near to Humphreys, especially without him there to protect her. She herself did not fear Humphreys any longer. She felt that she could handle him. "Martin wouldn't hurt me," she told herself. "Besides, George and Chris will be there to chaperone me." What worried her was Lars's reaction. He would be dead set against her going to Cellini, to Humphreys' home territory. So, after 2 days of inner turmoil, Amanda decided to go, without telling Lars.
A total of 22 ships made rendezvous above the ruined base on Vesta. The dust cloud from Fuchs's attack had finally settled, but Harbin could see nothing of the base. Not even the crater in which it had been situated was visible anymore. It was all obliterated by a new set of overlapping craters, fresh, sharp, raw-looking, circular scars on the asteroid's dark surface. They reminded Harbin of the scars left on sperm whales by the suckers of giant squid's tentacles. With no little bit of irony, Doric Harbin considered his position as he stood on the bridge of Shanidar. A man who treasured his solitude, who had never wanted to be dependent on anyone else. Now he was the commander of an entire fleet of spacecraft, attack ships, tankers, even surveillance drones that were spreading across the belt, seeking one infinitesimal speck in all that dark emptiness. Lars Fuchs. Although he far preferred to work alone, Harbin had been forced to admit that he could not find Fuchs by himself. The belt was too big, the quarry too elusive. And of course, Fuchs was aided covertly by other rock rats who gave him fuel and food and information while they secretly applauded his one-man war against Humphrey's space systems. Probably Astro Corporation was also helping Fuchs. There was no evidence of it, Harbin knew. No outright proof that Astro was supplying the renegade with anything more than gleeful congratulations on his continuing attacks. But Humphreys himself was certain that Astro was behind Fuchs's success. Diane had told Harbin that Humphreys was wild with rage, willing now to spend every penny he had to track down Fuchs and eliminate him once and for all. This armada was the result. Its costs to Humphreys were out of all proportion to the damage that Fuchs had done. But Humphreys wanted Fuchs destroyed, no matter what the cost, Diane said. Diane. Harbin reflected soberly that she had become a part of his life. I've become dependent on her, he realized. Even with the distance between them, she protected him against Humphreys' frustrated anger. She was the one who had convinced Humphreys to give Harbin command of this all-out campaign against Fuchs. She was the one who would be waiting for him when he returned with Fuchs's dead body. Well, he thought as he surveyed the display screen showing a scattering of his ships, now I have the tools I need to finish the job. It's only a matter of time. The surveillance probes were already on their way to quarter the belt with their sensors. Harbin gave the orders to his fleet to move out and start the hunt.
Self-satisfaction showed clearly on Martin Humphreys' face as he sat down at the head of the long dining table in his mansion. Diane Fairford was the only other person at the table, already seated at his right. "Sorry I'm late for lunch," Humphreys said, nodding to the servant waiting to pour the wine. "I was on the phone with Doug Stavanger." Fairford knew her boss expected her to ask what the call was about, but she said nothing. "Well, he's done it," Humphrey said at last, just a little bit nettled. "Stavanger's pulled it off. We're going to have a peace conference right here at Cellini. The world government's agreed to send their number two man, Willie Dieterling." Dan Fairford made herself look impressed. "Oh, the man who negotiated the Middle East settlement." "The very same," said Humphreys. "And the Rock Rats are sending a representative?" she prompted. "Three people. That big Australian oaf and two assistants." "Who'll represent Astro?" "Probably Pancho," he said lightly. "She's the real power on the board these days."
"It should be interesting," said Fairford.
"It should be," Humphreys agreed.
"It certainly should."
Lars Fuchs scowled at his visitor. Yves St. Clair was one of his oldest and most trusted friends. Fuchs had known the Quebecois since their university days together in Switzerland. Yet now St. Clair was stubbornly refusing to help him. "I need the fuel," Fuchs said. "Without it, I'm dead." The two men stood in Nautilus's cramped galley, away from the crew. Fuchs had given them orders to leave him alone with his old friend. St. Clair stood in front of the big freezer, his arms folded obstinately across his chest. When they had been students together, he had been slim and handsome, with a trim little pencil mustache and a smooth line of patter for the women, despite his uncouth accent. In those days, his clothes had always been in the latest fashion. His friends joked that he had bankrupted his family with his wardrobe. During his years of prospecting in the belt, however, he had allowed himself to get fat. Now he looked like a prosperous middle-aged bourgeois shopkeeper, yet his carefully draped tunic of sky blue was designed to minimize his expanding waistline.
"Lars," said St. Clair, "it is impossible. Even for you, old friend. I can't spare the fuel. I wouldn't have enough left to get back to Ceres."
Fuchs, dressed as usual in a black pullover and baggy slacks, took a long breath before answering.
"The difference is," he said, "that you can send out a distress call, and a tanker will come out for you. I can't."
"Yes, a tanker will come out for me. And do you know how much that will cost?"
"You're talking about money. I'm talking about my life."
St. Clair made a Gallic shrug. Since the attack on Vesta, Fuchs had survived by poaching fuel and other supplies from friendly prospectors on other ships plying the belt. A few of them gave freely. Most were reluctant and had to be convinced. Amanda regularly sent out schedules.